IVM. Welcome to States of Anarchy. I'm your host, Hamsini Hariharan. Every week, we discuss global affairs and foreign policy, all in the hope of making a little more sense of the world around us. This is our Q&A episode, where I feature questions and doubts from you. Today, we have three questions from Manasvini Hariharan, Shervin Dukuna, and Shruti Kalyanikar. Shervin and Shruti's questions are about studying international relations, so I'm going to get into them a little later. First up is Manasvini's question that we got on Instagram. She says, I would love to know what Biden's ascent as president means for the rest of the world's democracies, especially after global media has largely portrayed him as the person who's going to right all of Trump's PR wrongs. Thank you so much, Manasvini, for sending this question in. I know this question is on all of our minds with Joe Biden being sworn in as the American president last week. So Donald Trump has made some decisions during his term that have raised more than a few eyebrows. His tariff war with China resulted in the worst U.S.-China relations in a while. He's placed tariffs, sanctions, and even blacklisted Chinese companies under his America First policy. The U.S.'s Tibet Policy and Support Act of 2020, which supports Tibet's autonomy, also doesn't sit well with China. Trump's policies were often vague and conflicting. I read in an ORF report that Pyongyang and Tehran have posed a prominent nuclear weapon threat during his presidency. And of course, Trump's random tweets filled with grammatical mistakes make quite a reckless use of Twitter diplomacy. All in all, Trump's credibility in the international forum doesn't have a great track record. And the whole world is hoping that Biden would be better. To start off, Biden had proposed rejoining a number of important multilateral committees that Trump left. These include the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organization, and the Paris Climate Accord. Already in his first day of office, Biden re-entered the US into the Paris Treaty. Researchers say that the Biden administration faces a mammoth task at home. His primary job would start with healing America from deep political division thanks to the Trump presidency and the coronavirus pandemic. Biden's views of inclusion can be seen from his Capitol appointments. He's included a number of minorities in his government, especially South Asian brown people. According to some scholars, the international liberal order pins its hope on Biden for America to take a predominant position in world affairs, but with less volatility for which Trump was known for. So to answer Manasvini's question, let's take a look at Europe first. Trump had often berated European leaders for not paying their share for NATO. He also accused them of taking advantage of the US and its resources. By the end of the Trump presidency, transatlantic relations seemed quite shaky. Biden, on the other hand, has every intention to improve transatlantic relations with European countries. His main aim is to back the NATO military alliance, and the reasoning behind that is quite simple. It's to counter Putin's absolute power and to back the Russian civil society in Moscow, which brings us to one of the US's biggest threats. Biden and Putin have never seen eye to eye. Further rumors of Putin's alleged interference with the 2016 elections only added fuel to fire. So it makes sense that Moscow might expect an increase in hostility under Biden. And Biden supporting the NATO military alliance is further proof of his intentions towards Russia. However, according to a BBC article, a few Russian commentators feel that although bilateral relations were dicey under Trump, things might look up with Biden. Specifically, they hope that the two countries sign off on the US-Russia Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty, which expires this February. Now, China is obviously high on Biden's list of priorities. As I've mentioned before, Trump already inflicted a lot of damage to US-China relations. Unfortunately, that doesn't leave Biden much leeway to drastically change American foreign policy towards China. For the most part, Biden is expected to keep China at arm's length, starting with heavy US military presence. He's keen on strengthening alliances to challenge China, building partnerships with countries in the Indo-Pacific. China is actually hoping that the Biden administration will take a less disruptive approach towards them. It's possible that Biden will dial back on the tariff war that Trump was waging, but we can't be sure of what extent this will go on for. Biden will also cooperate with China on climate change initiatives, something Trump publicly didn't believe in. So that's definitely a win there. Moving on to West Asia, the region is in a flux. The last year of the Trump administration saw a lot of changes in the region. This includes the normalization of Israel-Arab relations, or at least the Arab parties officially recognizing Israel. And the second is the smoothening of Qatar-Arab relations. Biden has his job cut out for him with a defiant Turkey, who's a NATO ally, but has also been pretty hostile lately. There are, of course, multiple wars and factions in the West Asian region, with each championing their cause. Russian military presence in these conflicts doesn't make the job easier for him. The Biden administration also faces the question of the Iran nuclear deal. The deal was made to keep Iran from acquiring nuclear weapons, but the Trump administration got out of it, claiming that it was an unfair treaty. This move was also considered unilateral by the European members who were party to the deal. So West Asia is definitely a region that offers Biden a lot of challenges, some traditional, but some of them also more recent. In the East, however, Japan and South Korea are supposed to be traditional US allies, but due to some historical differences, they don't get along particularly well. From a realist lens, President Biden will have to balance commitment to allies with limited resources, unlike before. This challenge would include getting Japan and South Korea a little closer without the American financial muscle, especially due to the relations reaching a new low during the Trump administration. The Biden administration would also have to figure out the approach to take with North Korea. Trump and Kim Jong-un often threatened each other with nuclear war over Twitter, often in the depths of night. The three meetings that the two leaders had also didn't make any headway for disarmament. People expect Biden to take a less tense and eruptive approach than Trump. What remains to be seen is whether Biden and Kim warm up to each other despite their personal and national histories. Finally, what does the Biden presidency mean for India? I think it's interesting that Manaswini specifically asks what it means for democracies, because Biden's liberal internationalism obviously clashes with Modi's populist nationalism. In fact, his campaign website called out the Modi government for human rights violations in Kashmir and the controversial Citizenship Amendment Act. Now, India is well aware that the US needs India as a partner against China, so the response to it was quite unspoken. The Indian government, of course, firmly opposes any interference in its domestic affairs. Even though the American Vice President, Kamala Harris, has disapproved of some of Modi's policies, she has the wide approval of a large section of Indians because of her half-Indian heritage. Biden also has an impressive number of Indian Americans in his administration, notably two Kashmiris, according to an article by the News Minute. This definitely wins him some brownie points with the liberal Indian masses. It's important to clarify that while Indian Americans hold important positions in Biden's administration, it's not evident that they will push for better relations with India. They will obviously act in the American national interest. So that aside, how does it affect trade? While Trump and Modi have a very amiable relationship, think of Ab Ki Baar, Trump Sarkar, it isn't exactly reflective of India-US trade relations. I'm not saying that bilateral relations between the two countries are bad. They share fairly good relations. But Trump did revoke India's special trade status. He also taxed Indian steel and aluminium. So following that line of thought, if the US economy flourishes under Biden, India would definitely benefit from it as a good trading partner. Overall, while Biden won't worsen bilateral relations, he may not keep quiet on domestic affairs or human rights issues. And this is something we'll have to see play out. Now, the rest of the world is expecting Biden to right all of Trump's PR wrongs, as Manaswini pointed out. But I think it's also important to point out that this is a very divisive time in American history and American leadership. And so he has a huge mandate before him. And while we are not in the job of crystal gazing, it's important to recognize the limitations that Joe Biden has as the American president. This takes me back to something that Oscar Wilde once said, with age comes wisdom. Everyone has their fingers crossed that the oldest US president will prove to be a much better leader than his predecessor. That is something we'll have to watch play out. Now, that brings me to the second part of today's episode. I'm going to tackle two questions about studying international relations by Shervin de Kuna and Shruti Kalyanikar, which both came through Instagram. So Shervin says, 2 years ago, I finished my bachelor's in mass media and I've spent my time working for a few months and later spending the whole of 2020 at home due to the pandemic. I've decided to do my master's, and I came across one related to public policy at St. Xavier's, Mumbai. I wanted to know from someone like you who has academic and work experience in this field, that will it be worth the effort of taking up the course? The subjects have caught my interest, and I also wanted to know if the job prospects are strong in the field. Shruti's question is in a similar vein, and it was part of a larger conversation we were having about studying international relations. She said, is it all right if I'm a little honest about my consideration? I did listen to your podcast episode on studying IR, and something the guest Shibani Mehta also said was how overwhelming the course was. A lot of people study IR for the first time in their postgraduate, and me being one of them, I guess I'm trying to make the transition smoother instead of a straight leap of faith. A midway course like the Schwarzman Scholars seems like a good fit. But apart from extensive reading, are there any fellowship-type programs one could look out for? I Googled a lot, but didn't come across anything good in India. Or is the cold jump imperative? I hope it's not too naive. Thank you, Shervin and Shruti, for the questions. I want to answer these two, particularly because now is admission season, and a lot of people who are finishing up their undergrad, for example, are thinking about studying higher. So here's my suggestion for you about studying international relations or public policy in India or abroad. So what I'm going to do essentially is talk about what I believe, but don't take it as a gospel and come back to me in 10 years. There are many, many people in the field who'd give you different advice. So see what works for you. Since I started out studying, the field has really exploded in India. There are a lot more universities, a lot more jobs, and the field is surely but slowly growing. Public policy and international relations are related, but they're not the same. Public policy is about domestic policy or what happens within the country. It focuses on issues like public health or social development or urban development and so on. International relations, on the other hand, could deal with any of these domains that are in public policy, but it operates on a national or global level. So I'm going to stress on international relations because it's my specialization, but much of this advice applies to public policy as well. Now, here's what I believe. There's no one way to go about making a career in the field. Even now, when I tell people I work in international relations, they say, UPSC kab de rahe ho? Or when are you taking the UPSC in multiple Indian languages? The UPSC is definitely a great choice if you want to do foreign policy and become a practitioner. But it's definitely not the only route to follow. You could jump from your bachelor's to your master's to your PhD. You could work with think tanks or consultancy firms or public policy divisions of corporate. You could work with the government, NGOs. There's a whole gamut of jobs that are available. Now, I know what's at the back of your mind. It's a pandemic year. India is facing the highest levels of unemployment it has seen in 40 years. International travel is still off. With all of these challenges, I know that it can be daunting to be thinking about studying higher. But if this is something you really want to do but don't know where to start, here's what I suggest. First, decide if you want to study in India or abroad. You could also choose to study a language and work up from there. So studying Mandarin or Arabic or Swahili would be a good way to jump into international relations, particularly because language skills are essential. Now, India has great programs for international relations. South Asia University, Jawaharlal Nehru University, Jamia Millia, Delhi University, Jadavpur, Manipal, Pondicherry, Jindal, Shivnadar. These are universities that just come to my mind, but there are so many universities at the state level. You're not at a lack of options. Some of these require entrance exams for which you need to prepare. Some of these charge higher fees than the other. The good thing about doing your master's in India is that you'll know the Indian political context, and everyone comes back to the same job market, so it might be much cheaper for you to study here. On the other hand, studying abroad in a developed country is much more expensive, but there are a couple of key differences. For one, you could do a specialized master's degree in East Asian studies or international development or security studies. The other thing is these programs often stress on the need to learn foreign languages or quantitative skills or a base in economics, which is amazing when you want to be employable. Studying abroad is a wonderful experience, but honestly, it's such a personal one that I can't tell you if you should choose to do it. What I would advise, though, if you want to study abroad, is to pick something that's a little more niche than international relations, either an area like Latin America, East Asia, Middle East, or a field like security studies, international education, and so on. When you're done graduating, a niche background could help you in finding a job. So going back to the question that Shruti asked, she said, apart from extensive reading, are there any fellowship type programs one could look out for? I Googled a lot, but didn't come across anything good in India. Or is the cold jump imperative? I hope it's not too naive. Shruti, it is not at all naive. Switching to international relations for graduate school lets you bring your own background, and this will be your USP. Now, there are websites that you can look for fellowships, like profellow.com or opportunitydesk.org or utop.com. These are sites that list fellowships, conference calls, scholarships, or contests. Some international fellowships that you could consider are the Hudson Institute's Political Studies Summer Fellowship, Princeton in Asia, the Millennium Fellowship, or the Schwarzman Scholars. You could also check out international student conferences like HPEAR by Harvard or Asia-Pacific Week organized by Australian National University or the Yenching Global Symposium organized by Peking University. Of course, it's a pandemic year, so I don't know how these fellowships would work out, but it's good to keep an eye out for them. The other thing that you should definitely do is keep an eye on the Indian Ministry for Human Resource Development, because they put out calls for important government scholarships that are offered by foreign governments. Now, within India, if you want to jump into public policy, there are a bunch of fellowships, like the Young Indian Fellows, the LAMP Fellowship, fellowships offered by the state governments who want undergrads, SBI Youth Fellows, the Jagriti Yatra, and all of these would look really good on your resume, irrespective of what you want to work in. If you want short-term educational programs, the Takshashila Institute's graduate certificate programs, or China Capsule 101 by Asia Slate, or the Simpson Center's Nuclear South Asia program are all good options. There are, of course, a variety of free online courses that you can find on Coursera or Udemy or Unacademy. But more than anything, what I suggest is to start reading widely, as Indians were not used to reading deeply during our undergrad programs. So start off with book lists, dig and dig deep. Reading is always essential for a career in international relations, and it's better to start right this second. If you need suggestions, I've attached a reading list in the bio. Phew, now I'm going to get to Shervin's questions because they're a little harder to answer. Shervin had said, I wanted to know from someone like you who has academic and work experience in the field that it will be worth the effort to take up this course. I wanted to know what the job prospects are and if they're strong in the field. Now, I don't want to mislead anyone just because this is my field. But let me be honest, working in international relations in the first couple of years could be really dissuading. For one, the pay isn't high. Think tanks pay pretty low, between 20,000 to 40,000 rupees at the entry level. And often, if you need to be promoted, you'd need a PhD. Of course, if you're working in consultancy or international organizations or corporates, that figure would be much, much higher. So what I suggest is thinking about what kind of life you want. Do you maybe want to get a doctorate, which could open up quite a few doors, including teaching? Do you want to use your background in international relations to work with universities in a more administrative capacity? These are big questions that you'll have to think about. Finally, will it be worth the effort to take up a course in public policy or international relations? I can't say, yes, it will be worth the effort, because I don't know. What I can tell you is that international relations and public policy are fields that are highly rewarding and satisfactory in terms of the work you do. You focus on answering important questions about the world, and you may never arrive at the answers, but the journey is exciting. To be completely honest, how do any of us know what in life is worth the effort? I'm definitely trying to figure it out. On that philosophical note, we come to the end of today's podcast. Thank you, Manaswini, Shervin, and Shruti, for your questions. I hope that irrespective of whether you pursue a career in foreign policy or not, you will nurture your interest in the world. I'm attaching links about the Biden presidency in the episode description. Also, I recorded a longer in-depth episode about studying international relations with Shibani Mehta that Shruti had referred to. We recorded the episode in 2019, but the whole conversation is extremely relevant. So do go check out episode 19 of States of Anarchy, along with all the other links to programs and fellowships in the episode bio. This episode was written along with Ayushmita Banerjee and Vineet Vadavkar. If you have follow-up questions about anything that we spoke today or something in global affairs and foreign policy, then just email me at ivmstatesofanarchy@gmail.com or you can DM me on Instagram at statesofanarchy or Twitter at hamsinih. If you want to show us some love, send this episode to someone who you think may enjoy it. You can also leave us a rating on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. States of Anarchy is available on the IVM Podcast app website, but also on any other podcast app you can possibly think of. We'll be back next week.